Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting another deadly bombing in an African city. At least 14 people have been killed, 74 injured in a suicide bomb attack at a crowded market in the capital of Chad, N'Djamena. The incident came hours after a separate bombing in Nigeria's Borno state killed two. No group has claimed responsibility for either attack, but Chad blames Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group based in neighboring Nigeria, for a series of bombings and shootings in the Central African country in recent weeks. A police spokesman put the death toll at 15, adding the total includes the suicide bomber, a man dressed in a woman's burqa. Chad authorities banned the head-to-toe religious garment last month, citing the risk that attackers could use it as a disguise or hide explosives underneath. The bombing in Nigeria occurred in the northeastern city of Maiduguri, Boko Haram's birthplace, which is a frequent target for the group. The U.S. Embassy in Cairo has condemned the car bombing at the Italian consulate in Cairo that killed one person, saying, "We extend our condolences to the family of the victims of this attack and wish the injured a speedy recovery." The embassy statement said, "We reiterate our steadfast support for Egypt in its fight against terrorism." The blast early Saturday destroyed several floors of the historic building that is home to the consulate. The bombing comes amid an ongoing Islamic militant campaign targeting Egyptian security forces. Afghan intelligence officials say that a U.S. airstrike killed the top leader of a local Islamic State affiliate and more than 30 other militants near the country's rugged eastern border with Pakistan. You are listening to VOA News. The Greek parliament early Saturday approved the government's new economic reform plans aimed at helping secure funds for the European Union. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras made a personal appeal to lawmakers before the vote, which was held after midnight. Tsipras said, "We will make it. We will make it not only to stay in Europe, but also to live as equal partners with dignity and pride, seeking our rights in Europe and opening up a path for the other nations of Europe." In return for these tax hikes and pension cuts in the new Greek proposal, the government hopes to get a $60 billion EU bailout over the next 3 years. Voters, however, rejected austerity measures last Sunday in a referendum. The prime minister told lawmakers that mistakes were made in recent months in negotiations with the creditors, and the country now finds itself in a danger zone as it awaits the outcome of the EU vote. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Srebrenica, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Saturday to mark the 20th anniversary of the worst mass killing in Europe since World War II. The remains of 136 newly identified victims were buried alongside the more than 6,000 genocide victims at a memorial center just outside the eastern Bosnian town. On this day, 20 years ago, Bosnian Serb troops overran Srebrenica and went on a rampage, killing thousands of Muslim men and boys. Anger boiled over at the commemoration as people pelted the Serbian Prime Minister, Aleksandar Vučić, with water bottles and other objects. Vučić, once an ultranationalist, came to represent his country at the commemoration in an apparent gesture of reconciliation. As Vučić entered the cemetery to lay flowers, thousands booed and whistled. Some threw a shoe at him, others threw water bottles and other objects. Serena Williams has overcome a slow start, 8 double faults, and a nervy finish to beat Garbiñe Muguruza 6-4, 6-4 on Saturday for her 6th Wimbledon title, the 4th Grand Slam championship in a row and 21st major overall. The win means that Williams holds all 4 Grand Slam titles at once, completing the second, what's being called Serena Slam, of her career. What's more, she secured the 3rd leg of a calendar year Grand Slam. And if she wins the U.S. Open, which takes place later in the summer in New York City, she would become the first player to sweep all 4 majors in the same season since Steffi Graf did that in 1988. Hear more on our website at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Frankly, I don't see Lowassa crossing over from CCM to join with Ukawa. Firstly, because he is not the type of politician who has the boldness required to cross over.
Tension rises in the Tanzania ruling Chama Pinduzi party ahead of the October 25 general election.
So the parliament in March 2015 extends the tenure and the tenure of the office of the president. And it is what the Constitution of the Republic of South Sudan allows to happen.
The spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir rejects accusations. The leader unilaterally extended his mandate for 3 additional years.
There is no doubt that the cost is high. The resources required, significant. Is this asking too much? We say no.
And the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, asked the international community to forgive billions in debt owed by Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Tanzanian lawmaker says tension within the ruling Chama Pinduzi or CCM party will boost the chances of the opposition coalition to win the presidential vote. The CCM has ruled the country since it gained independence in 1961. Tundu Lissu of the Chadema party told me earlier that the opposition party's Ukawa coalition will take advantage of the apparent split among supporters of the ruling party to win the October presidential poll.
My take of the current situation is we are playing for the end game now. This is the end game for CCM, and it has been this way for quite a while. The fact that Edward Lowassa has been taken out of the race will definitely cause even bigger tensions and divisions within CCM, and it will surely put us in a much better position to win power in October.
There are suggestions that his exclusion from the nominees for the candidacy or the flag bearer of the ruling party, he could actually join the opposition front. Do you foresee this happening, especially when he has been a prominent member of CCM for all this while?
I don't see it happening. Frankly, I don't see Lowassa crossing over from CCM to join with Ukawa. Firstly, because he is not the type of politician who has the boldness required to cross over. But it is also a fact that if he crosses over to the opposition, there is no way he can be our flag bearer in the coming battles in October. So I don't see any incentive for him to cross over except for the maybe retaliation.
So what has been the reaction of your supporters, the Ukawa, as you call it, the United Opposition Front? What has been the reaction so far when news broke about this?
Well, I think our reaction has been very cool, actually, very quiet. We have been preparing ourselves for whoever comes from CCM, whether it be Lowassa, whether it be, and whoever comes, we've been prepared. So the fact that it is not Lowassa does not in any way lower our level of preparation.
So what do you think your realistic chances are to winning power from the CCM candidate, especially seeing how powerful Lowassa was? He was drawing people from all walks of life. Some of us have seen the videos and the pictures of his attempt to win the flag bearership. Now that he's been sidelined, how confident is the opposition of winning power from the CCM, especially when the CCM has controlled the presidency since independence?
Our chances are very, very good. They were very good with Lowassa. They are still very good with whoever comes. Look, the measure of Lowassa's strength must first of all be measured from within his party. This guy has not been able to win, the best 5 from within his party. The fact that he was drawing huge crowds, and we know the reasons why he was drawing huge crowds. This guy's campaign has been very well financed. He's been spending billions to get people on the streets, to get people to show support to him. But the fact that he's been sidelined tells you that the strength that was apparent was just that. It wasn't real strength. If he cannot win within his party, it tells you that he wasn't as strong as he appeared to be. But on the other side, for us, we have been preparing for the October shutdown for the past 4 years. We have been our candidates for members of parliament, our candidates for councils, our presidential candidates have been on the campaign trail for the past 4 years. We have built very powerful structures everywhere in the country. And they were going to have a big say in the outcome come October.
And how united is the opposition in coming up with a single presidential candidate to face the CCM candidate in October?
We're in very good set. You can imagine we have four political parties that are part of this UKAWA coalition. We will always have tensions here and there. It's only to be expected. But the fact that we've been together for the past 2 years tells you that this year is different. This year is completely different from the past four general elections.
Tundu Lissu is a member of the Tanzanian Parliament representing the opposition Chadema Party. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The South Sudanese presidential spokesman has denied accusations that the president, Salva Kiir, unilaterally extended his mandate for 3 additional years. Critics say Kiir unconstitutionally extended his term with support from parliament. Rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar fighting the government say Kiir's continued stay in power is illegitimate. Mr. Kiir's mandate was officially scheduled to end on July 8th. But presidential spokesman Atenyi Wekatene told me that parliament extended the leader's mandate in March in accordance with the constitution.
It is not President Salva Kiir trying to extend his mandate. Rather, it is the parliament, which represents the will of the people of South Sudan, that due to the current, which in any event would have made it difficult for the conduct of general election in April. So the parliament in March 2015 extends its tenure and the tenure of the office of the president. And it is what the Constitution of the Republic of South Sudan allows to happen.
Wouldn't this plunge the country further into crisis, especially when those in parliament are basically those that side with him?
Unless the politics is defined, the politics we know, which is also happening in the United States, the SPLM has a majority in the parliament, and that it wasn't about the issue of whether the SPLM wanted to lengthen its rule in South Sudan. Rather, it was about the necessity, because Riek Machar, leader of the rebels, has made the country in war, because he forced the country to be in war, which necessitated the extension. If the war did not erupt in South Sudan, President Salva Kiir and all the parliamentarian would have gone for general election, whereby the people of South Sudan would have been availed the opportunity to choose their leaders. But unfortunately, it did not happen because of the war. Last time we said we must conduct the election, whether it was going to be partial. If it, you know, the election would have not included the three states of the Greater Upper Nile, that is the Dongle State, Unity, and Upper Nile State. But the international community asked us not to do this. We took heed to the advice of the international community. So the other options, which would avail South Sudan from the political vacuum, is the extension through the parliament. We cannot allow the country to run into vacuum and to run into lawlessness, when in actual fact we are better placed when we were elected, and we are not unconstitutional more than the rebels themselves.
Ambassador Susan Rice has rejected the extension of President Kiir's mandate and said that only through a peace agreement that such a mandate could be renewed pending elections. What do you say to that?
With my respect to Ambassador Susan, called or non-accepting the extension of the tenure of the President Salva Kiir, I would like to reiterate this one, as it has to be clear. First, the extension came as a result of the constitutional mandate of the Republic of South Sudan, not of any other country. And what we did to extend the tenure of the president is within the constitutional mandate of our parliament. So I don't know why Ambassador Susan would reject this.
Don't you think that the renewing of the mandate will further deepen the crisis as the conflict continues? Don't you think it will make it worse?
What is the alternative? Would the alternative be that the government leave the power in the bathroom and run into bush, so that the South Sudan become ungovernable? That's the alternative. If that is not, then I would like to say it is like some people wanted to tune into what Riek Machar was saying yesterday in his press conference, when he said that the government of South Sudan is unconstitutional by midnight of July 8th. And many people try to also reiterate the position of Riek Machar. The question is Riek Machar constitutional? Is it constitutional that you have to revolt against the constitution and you try to uphold the constitution after rebelling against the constitution? Is that what the world wanted us to do?
Attorney Wek Attorney is the spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. The president of Liberia has appealed to the international community to help fund Ebola recovery programs in the three countries worst affected by the deadly virus. At an international conference in New York, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf also called on nations to forgive billions in debt owed by Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The theme of the two-day conference is about getting to zero cases of Ebola, staying there, and then moving into the recovery phase. The UN said that the three West African countries would be seeking about $3.2 billion in financial commitments for the next 2 years. But President Johnson Sirleaf said their sub-regional plan for recovery would be closer to $4 billion. Speaking on behalf of the Mano River Union, which includes Guinea and Sierra Leone, she called on the international community to cancel more than $3 billion of their debt.
There is no doubt that the cost is high. The resources required, significant. Is this asking too much? We say no, because a strong Mano River Union can be a formidable force for recovery and resilience in the sub-region.
In the past year, Ebola has affected more than 27,000 people and killed 11,000 in West Africa. The epidemic has recently slowed dramatically, with about 30 new cases identified each week. Liberia had been declared Ebola-free, but lost that designation after a handful of new cases appeared. Guinea and Sierra Leone have not yet gotten to zero cases. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said the UN mission created last year to help West Africa battle Ebola will begin shutting down next month, but support will continue through the World Health Organization and UN country teams. He urged countries and financial institutions to be generous with their support, noting that the impact of Ebola has been far-reaching, eroding progress on peace and development. International financial institutions and individual countries began announcing their pledges Friday afternoon. The United States is contributing $266 million. Total commitments were not immediately available. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Two Ugandan presidential hopefuls were arrested and detained for a day. The two, Chisa Besigye, the former leader of the main opposition party, the FDC, and Amama Mbabazi, the former prime minister, were detained on Thursday under what the police said was preventive arrest. The two were due to attend separate meetings to promote their presidential candidacy. Nicholas Opio is a Ugandan constitutional lawyer. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the capital, Kampala, and asked him about this idea of preventive arrest.
Well, first of all, that is a colonial legislation, a legislation that dates back to the British rule in Uganda. It is a law that has been on our law books for a very long time. The new Constitution of the Republic of Uganda, which was enacted in 1995, requires that all laws that predate the Constitution should be read as to bring it into conformity with the progressive Bill of Rights in our Constitution. So my own sense is that that law is completely unnecessary in modern times. It is unconstitutional. I urge the government of Uganda to read the law to bring it into conformity with the progressive provisions in our Constitution.
Do you equate this law to the detention without trial law that was there previously?
In effect, and in fact, in practice, the way it is being used, they are not any different. The context and times might differ or might be different, but in effect, and in the way it is being applied, is absolutely no different. The law is being applied selectively against people who are perceived to be critical of this government, or those who pose a challenge President Museveni's hold on to power. So it is the same, but it's just a law in a different name.
Does the public order management law that was passed recently provide for these preventive arrests?
It does not provide for preventive arrests. The Public Order Management Act requires that before you hold a public assembly, you should notify the police 3 days in advance. The word is notification, not permission. But the basis for preventive arrest is the Criminal Procedure Act, a law that was enacted many, many years ago before Uganda became an independent country. That is where they derived the basis for arresting people, quote unquote, on preventive arrest.
Would it be fair to consider these preventive arrests where somebody is just confined to his home or just picked up from the street and taken to jail as unconstitutional?
There is a decision of the Magistrates Court in Kasangati here in Kampala that made it very clear that detaining somebody in his home is unlawful, is a violation of the Constitution, because somebody's home is not a gazetted place for detention. So it is quite clear that preventive arrest and detaining people in their homes and preventing them from coming out of their houses is unlawful. There's a court decision to that effect. It is evidently unconstitutional, a violation of fundamental rights and freedoms provided for in our Constitution. But more importantly, the provisions on preventive arrest are being challenged presently in the Constitutional Court in cases that are being filed by many activists. So it is a law that is under challenge, but also a law that has been declared by lower courts to be unconstitutional and unlawful.
If the lower courts had ruled that this law is unconstitutional and the government has ignored it, how sure are people that the government won't ignore the decision of the Constitutional Court?
Well, the best that we can do is to ask court to pronounce itself. The rest is a moral obligation on the state of this country to respect a law that they have passed themselves, to live to the value of the very constitution that they enacted. That's what we can do. But also, more importantly, if they refuse to obey a court decision, a court order, it will be seen for what it is, that is becoming an increasingly intolerant government that doesn't even care about court decision and the rule of law in this country.
Nicholas Opio is a Ugandan constitutional lawyer. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kampala. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari is scheduled to visit Washington later this month. The visit comes after years of strained relations between the U.S. and Nigeria under former President Goodluck Jonathan. Chris Stein has more from VOA's Regional Bureau in Dakar on what this visit might bring.
Officials from Mr. Jonathan's administration were openly critical of American policy towards Nigeria. Nigeria's ambassador to Washington complained the United States was not doing enough to help fight the Islamist Boko Haram insurgency that has ravaged the country's northeast. That relationship may change under Mr. Buhari. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry attended the new president's inauguration in May, and Deputy Secretary of State Anthony Blinken visited the Nigerian capital, Abuja, this week. While giving few specifics, Blinken said President Barack Obama would listen to Mr. Buhari when they meet on July 20th.
Any ideas that Nigeria has, any requests it makes, we'll sit down and we'll talk about it and work through it.
Jamestown Foundation African Affairs analyst Jacob Zen says the meeting will likely focus on smoothing over relations between the two countries, with President Obama expected to show support for President Buhari's agenda, particularly his stated focus on combating corruption and insecurity.
The U.S. side is optimistic about the prospects of President Buhari focusing on prioritizing issues that the U.S. considers key concerns.
That does not mean the United States will take a greater role in the fight against Boko Haram. In the past, the United States trained Nigerian troops and provided non-lethal equipment like vehicles and uniforms, but turned down Nigerian requests for weapons. Zen says President Buhari is unlikely to leave Washington with much more than commitments for further training and intelligence sharing.
The fight against Boko Haram will continue to be a Nigeria-led initiative.
Nigeria is working with neighbors Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin to put together a joint task force to combat the group. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Cigarette smoking has been linked to a host of health problems, including lung cancer and heart disease. Now comes the suggestion of a possible association between smoking and schizophrenia, a severe mental disorder marked by delusional thoughts and hallucinations. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
Cigarette smoking is very common among people with mental disorders, especially schizophrenia. It's something that Samir Johar, psychiatric researcher at King's College London, noticed.
As a psychiatrist, it's always something you think about, because you always see patients with psychotic illnesses smoking. People generally put it down to self-medication.
Johar made his comments in a podcast posted by the online journal The Lancet Psychiatry, which published his study of the relationship. Findings by the King's College team offer the intriguing notion that cigarette smoking may in some ways increase the risk of developing schizophrenia. The researchers analyzed 61 studies worldwide and found the tobacco habit is three times more common among schizophrenic patients coming to treatment for the first time compared to the general population. Approximately one quarter of people who live in Western countries are cigarette smokers. James McCabe is a senior study co-author and doctor of psychiatric research at King's College. He says the fact that more than half of schizophrenics smoke is not surprising. What the finding does challenge, he says, is the belief that people who suffer from psychosis are smoking to ease their symptoms.
If the explanation was self-medication, you would expect that when people started to develop schizophrenia, they would be no more likely to smoke than anybody else. And the smoking would then develop in response to the symptoms.
But the authors found people with schizophrenia started smoking at a younger age than other smokers before psychotic symptoms appeared. There is a suggestion, but not the findings to prove it, that nicotine stimulates production of the brain chemical dopamine. Dopamine helps control the brain's reward and pleasure centers. Increased levels have been observed in patients with psychosis, and medications to treat schizophrenia aim to reduce dopamine activity. If a definitive link is ever made between smoking and the development of schizophrenia, McCabe says patients at risk for the disorder due to family history or substance abuse might be well advised to kick the habit.
Now, there are many reasons why we should try to reduce rates of smoking in the population for physical health reasons. But this suggests that possibly doing so would also actually benefit people's mental health.
The authors are calling for more in-depth studies investigating the role of sporadic smoking and nicotine addiction in the development of psychotic disorders. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
For dance with where this party go start. I want Saleh, yeah. I want ballet.
What you want?
Makale and the party back in your
lay.
Not to your business, but in a party you come. Left me make a overload if we ask you gonna do. Oh, oh, yeah, yeah. Somebody, every man deserves a lady. Come to party, oh no. Come jam, shake your body. Come show me, say you savvy. If you really ready, oh no. Before you even start the party, check for G-string or bikini. If not that smart and ready, oh no. Come see tutu, so jam and so we not the party. But see well it's you can it get already. Babos, Lokoti, Babadori, waiting you say. Tell me if you really done ready. Yeah, 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 yeah.
They
yeah.
Dance, they swing and they bounce it. No say, and they dance to party. You see me they jump, they swing cool and cozy. No go say, and they dance to party. You see me among sexy, beautiful ladies. No go say, and they dance to party.
this place. Ah! Look on, what's this?
Baby, now you are one girl. Give you everything, make you number one girl. You know me.
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, pay close attention to African opinions on and attitudes towards the United States. Every week, I pay close attention to what is happening between the United States and the whole continent of Africa. This week, I pay close attention to the forthcoming visit of the president to East Africa and to show the historical connections between his visit to Ghana and his visit to Kenya and Ethiopia, as people are now talking about the itinerary. There are five things that are relevant, in my opinion, with regard to the president's visit to East Africa. First of all, it is very important for the president to do what other presidents of the United States who try to connect with their points of origins in Europe or in the United States. So far, all the presidents of the United States were people of European descent, and they did not come from all over Europe. They came from the British Isles, meaning Great Britain. They come from England, Scotland, Wales, or Ireland. And of course, certain American presidents who came from the mother country, as some people would like to say, England being the source of colonialism, and going there and visit those people from England. Now, when you look at President Obama and his journey to Africa, you now see three scenarios. His visit to Ghana was very striking, and many people wrote many things. There can be many master's theses and dissertations about Obama and Africa and his pilgrimage to the continent. Going to Ghana was a very important development, and many of us spoke about it. And there are many bloggers and many other opinions about that visit. Now, going to Kenya becomes a very important development because Obama is going home to the people of East Africa, people of Kenya. He has been to East Africa before by going to Tanzania and then, of course, going to South Africa, starting with Senegal, going all the way that way. So this is the third journey for the president from the Ghanaian visit, which had many Pan-African connections for him. And the legacy of Tom Mboya came to that discussion. The legacy of Tom Mboya is going to be more pronounced when he goes back this time, because here, history in its plain ways of bringing ironies and paradoxes in world history is going to come back in full force. Because when the president goes to Kenya, the spirit of Tom Mboya is alive. Because Tom Mboya was instrumental in bringing all those Kenyan kids to the United States. And the spirit of Tom Mboya, the spirit of Jomo Kenyatta, the spirit of all the other leaders of Kenyan society whose lives were very much linked to these young Kenyans who ended up in the United States. This is a very important point in talking about U.S. policy towards Africa, because here, history in its very strange ways of doing things. That's one of the major reasons why, personally, when I look at all these historical narratives about the Obama presidency, you wonder who is writing the video. God himself, in my opinion, is the greatest movie maker. He writes videos. Because when you go back and you look at what we now call Kenya, a British colony, just like Ghana, Gold Coast, Gambia, the hot dog country of the British Empire on the Atlantic, you go up to Sierra Leone, where you have diamonds, you go all the way back to Nigeria, which was the biggest prize of the British in West Africa. You go to East Africa, and you have Uganda, where the British colonialists called the Pearl of the Empire, near Lake Victoria. And of course, colonialism changed those names. But when you come back to Kenya and you see the spirit of Jomo Kenyatta, you can see the relationship between the labor movement in Africa and the labor movement in the United States. Many people who talk about President Obama may not even pay attention to the labor movement and what the labor movement did to facilitate the visit of Tom Mboya to the United States. If you read his own book talking about the independence of Kenya, you can see evidence there where he talks about meeting Senator Kennedy before he became president. And that relationship is now known, it's part of history. But when Obama goes to Kenya, the spirit of Tom Mboya is very much alive. When we talk about democracy, ethnicity, racism, bigotry among human beings, we have to pay close attention to the miracle of Obama, how Obama became president of America. And I think the Kenyans, all their religious people, have to sit down and think big about how history sometimes makes metaphysics really funny. Even Hollywood could not have talked about an Obama. Obama is real. They will have a big time in Hollywood to duplicate a mythified story of Barack Hussein Obama. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Cornelius Tino. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a friend is someone who knows the song in your heart and can sing it back to you when you have forgotten the words. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late June, the U.S. State Department issued its country reports on human rights practices, as it has done every year since 1977. The reports, which cover 199 countries and entities, strive to provide a comprehensive and factual review of human rights conditions and practices around the world. This year's report notes that although the focus is, as always, on the actions of governments, the year 2014 will be remembered for atrocities committed by non-state actors such as ISIL, Boko Haram, al-Shabaab, Jabhat al-Nusra, and regional incarnations of al-Qaeda against innocent civilians, as well as for the remarkable brutality of their actions. But inhumane treatment of civilians was not limited to extremist groups. The government of Syria and its affiliated militias used equally brutal tactics against their own people, including massacres, indiscriminate bombings, summary executions, rape, and forced displacement of non-combatants. Elsewhere, numerous states continued to use violence or repressive laws to silence domestic dissidents and aggressively crack down on freedom of expression, including through the use of new media. Governments blocked access to websites, and in some cases, human rights activists who use the Internet were tried as criminals and punished as terrorists. The reports pointed out that there is a strong correlation between corruption, human rights abuses, and repressive governance. Again and again, 2014 saw unrestrained rulers use corruption to cement their overall grip on power. For 39 years, the Human Rights Country Reports have documented stories of abuse and rights denied. Over the years, they have expanded to include human trafficking, internet freedom, the rights of persons with disabilities, and the LGBTI community. The discomfort that these reports sometimes cause does more to reinforce than to undermine the value and credibility of these reports, said Secretary Kerry. Truth cannot successfully be evaded or dented or defeated, not over time. It cannot be changed. The truth wins out. Leaders who are upset by these findings should look at how people are treated in their own countries. Every country, including the United States, has room to improve, said Mr. Kerry. The path to global respect always begins at home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.